welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. That was a new theme song you heard there from Mark Pilkington in the UK, and we're still trying to get it completely dialed in, so keep listening for that. This fall I was in Houston, and partly out of nostalgia for my Northern California home, I watched the kind of cheesy television series Sons of Anarchy, which, for those of you who don't know, is about a biker gang in rural Northern California, set in modern times, but with a connection to the countercultural past. And it was not a great show, but interesting enough to keep me engaged for a while. I was partly interested in the way that the countercultural origins of the biker club were seen as this kind of utopian moment, and that part of the narrative was about how they became instead these gun runners. But there were two things about the show that really struck me as being interesting and kind of unusual, if also somewhat unbelievable. One was that the way that the show dealt with drugs. So, of course, you know, you can associate biker gangs not just with drugs in general, but with one particularly pernicious drug, crystal meth. There's these relationships go long back, and they are storied and grounded in authenticity, but they're also part of the stereotype of the biker as the gang that's running meth, particularly in the sorts of rural communities that were represented in the show. But the way the show dealt with this, in order for us to feel not too terrible about our heroes, who are actually in many ways very repulsive, unethical characters, but having them push drugs would be a little bit too much. And so they adopted the fiction that the gang, the Sons of Anarchy, were not into crystal meth. They didn't like drugs in their town, and so they insisted that nobody deal drugs in their town, and they didn't deal drugs either. In fact, one of the conflicts is around some other people who deal drugs. And I just thought this bit of fantasy was fascinating for what it represented about drugs and about a certain kind of nostalgia for a world without drugs, and even for a criminality without drugs. But the second thing was more interesting to me, at least I don't watch a lot of television, so maybe this is less remarkable than it seemed to me, but that the main dynamics of the show involved this white biker gang dealing with other biker gangs, and one of those biker gangs was Mexican. And another gang, though not a biker gang per se, were white Aryan supremacists. And then a third gang, who were not bikers but urban gang, were black. And so a lot of the plot around the show was between these different racial groups. And it wasn't until late into the first season, when the gang get busted and they go to prison, that I realized that what they were doing in the show, both inside prison and outside prison, was representing the reality of prison in the sense that it's an incredibly segregated, racially defined space. And that our heroes, again, are sort of like the good white people fighting the Aryan racists over their right to deal guns with blacks and Mexicans. So that what made our heroes ethical in the sense is that they were able to transact criminal enterprises with people of other colors. So leaving the show aside, I thought it was very interesting because of the way that it sort of popped up a reality about American experience that is very occluded from us, which is the reality of prisons, and particularly the incredible racialized dimension and violent dimension of prison life. So I thought that was those two points were a good way to introduce our guest today, who I'm very happy to have on the show. Charles Shaw is a really great writer and raconteur, and as you'll hear, his own personal story and his politics are bound up in a really wonderful way, and I'm really happy to have him on the show. But before we introduce him, I want to bring on our co-host, Majid Daou, calling in today from a cell phone, so we're hoping that it works out. How are you doing, Maja?
I'm doing good, Eric. Thanks. How are you?
Pretty good. Sounds all right to me.
Yahoo!
we'll get into stuff later, but I'm curious, do you have any opinions about biker gangs? Does that stir your imagination?
Well, it's interesting because of what you said about how most people don't know about, like, the culture of prisons and stuff like that. But, I mean, that was part of my own upbringing. Like, I grew up very aware of that because my own father was a drug dealer, in fact. He dealt cocaine, and he was in prison for the majority of my young life. And later on, as an adult, I talked to him a lot about his time in prison and about prison in general. And in fact, one of the things that I got from my father was my interest in astrology. And while he was in prison, he would do astrological charts for the prisoners. And he was kind of into, like, looking at their astrology for the different crimes that they committed. And he, he was kind of like a spiritual crazy dude who, like, went to India and stuff like that and was really into all this occult stuff. So he got to see the inner workings of prison from that, you know, kind of occult perspective, and would see what happened with, like, the different racial gangs and people's motivations for, you know, being in there. So he was kind of, like, interested in that. So for me, it affected me in a very personal way growing up with that culture. It wasn't necessarily from the biker culture, but it was from the drug and prison aspect.
Yeah, well, that's amazing. Well, I think it's no better introduction to our guest. Charles, thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Very much for having me, Eric. And Maja, thank you for for opening up and kind of telling us all that. You know, there's an old activist named Chuck Armsbury. He's one of the co-founders of the November Coalition, which is a group based out of Eastern Washington that does prison letter writing campaigns. He's a great guy. You know, and him and his partner Nora Callahan, they're kind of like, you know, the grandma and grandpa of the movement. And you know, he said to me, when I, you know, met him in person for the first time, he said, you know, that he's welcoming me into the family. He says it's a, you know, a very small family, and usually the only kinds of people that care about this issue, you know, is if you've either been a prisoner or loved a prisoner.
It's true.
But today, though, today, because of the war on drugs and because of the war on consciousness, it's now something that is reaching beyond that, you know. Mm. So many more people are stepping forward with their stories and feeling, you know, comfortable to kind of step out and talk about it in a way that, you know, we just simply couldn't, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's what I felt was significant about that show, because even though clearly their demographic was a certain kind of either people who identify themselves with a certain outlaw life or who kind of fantasize about that, the fact that they were so explicit about introducing an element of American racial dynamics that we really don't pay very much attention to, it indicated an opening. To me, it indicated a sort of recognition that these dynamics are now no longer just on the other side of the wall, and that they're part of our larger world, and that we have to kind of engage them. So I want to talk more about that, but I really think that your whole political engagement makes, you know, it makes even more sense to people when they hear your story. So I know you tell your story a lot, but if you could give us the Cliff Notes radio version, I think it really helps. It really helps focus where you're coming from in an impressive way.
Sure. Yeah, I've been getting a lot of practice lately, so we'll see how I can do it. But, you know, the long and short of it is that I was raised in Chicago in a conservative family. My mother's family was from a line of working-class immigrants from Sicily. My father's family was in ward politics, and so my great-grandfather was a ward boss. And so you have this interesting middle-class, you know, mix there in the America heartland. I grew up really conservative, but my father was involved in the entertainment business. He worked for Warner Communications for 20-some-odd years. He was a concert promoter. And I kind of straddled these two, you know, lives. But it was a real violent, really abusive upbringing, both at home and in school and in the areas that I lived in. And I also had the misfortune of living in a neighborhood with a sexual predator when I was very young, about 9 years old, at the time I was about 14. I was shipped off to military school where I suffered a lot of, you know, ritualized hazing and abuse and rape for a period of 2 years. I went through college at Boston University as a very troubled young man. But as I got out of college, my family collapsed. My father had been involved in some unsavory and salacious business opportunities, including embezzling from his company, and he had a kind of a breakdown, and my parents lost everything, and we went overnight from being kind of very comfortable to having absolutely nothing. And in the process, I was not very, you know, well-equipped to handle crises or things like this, and I was kind of a spoiled kid, and I kind of had a big meltdown, lost myself in drugs, which is, you know, a very common story that we hear these days, the collapse of the American family, and then the, you know, subsequent escape into oblivion. But that was kind of what 10 years of my life became, except that I fell down really far, and spent most of my time with a brutal crack addiction, which led me to some periods of homelessness and a couple of felony convictions and revolving door in and out of the rehabs and the shelters and the halfway houses and all of this. Right around the time of 9/11, when I was about 31 years old, I was compelled, you could say, to get my life together following the events of 9/11. I had a kind of a shattering of the psyche that day, whatever remnants, whatever kind of like ligature was still attached to this, you know, necrotic limb that I called my life of, you know, in this old paradigm, it kind of like started ripping off that day. And I just had this overwhelming, you know, conviction that this new world wouldn't have a lot of patience for somebody, you know, with, you know, weaknesses and handicaps and troubles like mine. So I really set about the task of putting my life together. Exile Nation chronicles the next 10 years. It goes through that whole 10-year arc of how I came out of this addiction and put my life together. And in the process, you go through, you know, two distinct phases, and it's the two volumes of the book. The first volume covers the political awakening, and it opens on the day I'm sent to prison and winds its way all the way back to that same day when the book closes, the first volume. And, you know, that's the kind of the whammy, which is that halfway through this 10-year healing journey, I'm sent to prison for possessing 14 capsules of MDMA. And the story tells you about how I came to find psychedelic medicine, and I came to find MDMA not for recreational purposes, but because I was seeking healing for post-traumatic stress disorder, which was a consequence of this violence and this life that I had lived. And then, of course, the, you know, terrible toll that 10 years of a crack addiction can take on a human being. And then the back half of the book, after I serve my time and I get out and I face a true existential crisis where I'm suicidal within a number of months. I find my way into the shamanic medicines. By grace, I find my way to ayahuasca and then into the kind of neo-tribal subcultures, and I discover the Burning Man culture and all of this. And in the next 4 years, I kind of have a spiritual awakening. So, you know, the two halves of the book chart really kind of like the intellectual political awakening, which leads to the almost suicidal disillusionment. And then after that, you know, you have, well, how does one rectify oneself with this world and with the universe and live and develop a sense of strength, and not only that, but recover and I hope, you know, at least in my case, to provide inspiration and then to dedicate oneself to that kind of service. And, you know, so it's a memoir. It is a hero's journey. It's a shamanic journey into the underworld. I mean, it's all of these archetypes that are, you know, so nascent and so relevant to what we're dealing with today, all of us, with this kind of, you know, parallel transformation, cultural transformation, personal transformation.
Where were you in that process when you went to prison? At that point you had already discovered the psychedelic underground, and was in a way finding how, you know, quote-unquote drug culture could be healing as well as harming. Obviously, it's a very different kind of drug culture, which itself is a very is an interesting topic. But just personally, you were already kind of opening up to a sort of neo-shamanic view of healing when you went to prison. Is that right?
I would say that that part of it, Eric, didn't come until I was really confronted with, you know, my own survival. But it was, you know, if you want to talk about a great kind of monkey wrench thrown in the work, or, you know, in the second act of a film, you know, that's kind of like what happened with, it was within 3 months of me being reintroduced to psychedelics after a, you know, almost a, you know, dozen year hiatus, maybe almost 15 years for, in the case of LSD, and I had never taken DMT before. And within a 2 week period, I was introduced to MDMA after, you know, a couple of years of people trying to warm me up to the idea that it was a good medicine for post-traumatic stress disorder. But then LSD within 2 weeks after that, and then 2 weeks after that, I had, the kind of, KND cocktail that Joseph Turner was famous for experimenting with, kind of 60% liquid DMT, 40% liquid ketamine given intramuscularly. And that was kind of like my breaking open the head dose. I had this all within a very compact period of 2 weeks. I went from being, you know, a really rather angry and annoying, buzz-cutted, secular, atheist radical to knowing that there was something far bigger and far beyond anything I had ever imagined, but not really understanding how to live with it. And so in this period, I was kind of aimless and ungrounded for this very short period. And concurrently to this, Eric, you know, there's this whole other story of me, you know, making, you know, enemies out of the Chicago police because of my activist work and an ongoing case that was happening. And so, you know, as I'm kind of fighting this good fight as the activist, I'm losing interest in participating in any of it anymore because I'm finding this whole other realm that exists. And just as the gate is cracked open and I see a light in the distance and I feel like, wow, there really is meaning. Something beautiful is going to happen. I'm really going to finally get my life in a place where I want it to be. I got busted and then had to go to prison. Yeah.
Well,
I mean, I know.
It's interesting to me because, like, for people that are in that kind of spot in your consciousness where you were when you went to prison, prison can actually be this gnarly potentiator. Like, you can look at some of the most famous works politically, especially the people have written, like, you can look at, you know, Gandhi or Martin Luther King or, like, you know, even Hitler. I mean, we don't really like to think that way, but, like, Mein Kampf was written in prison. And prison can really afford people who are going through these kind of transformations that time to articulate and, you know, really condense all of these things into, like, something extremely solid where they might not have ever been able to do it had they not gone to prison. So, I mean, do you think that, like, that is what getting busted for you did during that time?
Oh, yes. And thank you so much for, you know, kind of saying that, because it really is. You know, Malcolm X, who's my personal hero and who
sure.
I've taken so much inspiration from. He said, you know, that prison is second only to, you know, to college for getting an education. You know, and that he felt that prison was, you know, of course, and here's the great secret for so many of us, at least in the radical side. And this is not to diminish, you know, the cultural holocaust that is the war on drugs and our prison system in this country and how many lives it's devastating. But for the few, you know, that allow the experience to radicalize them and allow it to help shape their future work, it becomes actually that, you know, crossroads. It becomes that critically important step in their journey. For me, it was that. It allowed me, I guess, you know, the political consciousness that I was generating, you know, the previous 5 years was intellectual. I mean, I was in the streets, I was organizing, you know, I was fighting the system, you know, for whatever that accomplished. I was trying to do something direct, but I wasn't really learning. But when you want to talk about consciousness expansion and political awakening, when you are locked down with, you know, hundreds of other young black men and Latino men, and even, you know, these, you know, horrendous white men that I met, you know, these racists and these Aryan Nation people who didn't take too kindly to me. But you really get to see the reality of life in this country, and you understand, you know, economics in a truly visceral sense. You understand the populist politics from, you know, a very, very direct way. So, yeah, I took the opportunity, you know, part of my coping mechanism just to survive was to make sure that I was looking at it like a journalist. I think it allowed me to kind of detach just a little bit so that I didn't have to really, really feel what I was feeling at the time. But I couldn't help it. I mean, I'm too stubborn and I got too much of a mouth on me. And, you know, when the racist stuff started up, I just, you know, I couldn't just sit back and let it go by. So, needless to say, I got a real hard firsthand lesson in racial dynamics.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that. I mean, I've heard you talk before, and partly also about like how you went in there with a certain idea of what politics were, and then had that really shaken up. But also just how you managed to navigate that highly racialized environment in there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the first and foremost, you know, I went in with very romanticized notions of, you know, leading some kind of movement, you know, kind of with images of, you know, Leonard Peltier or Mumia Abu-Jamal or, you know, some of these, you know, kind of older, more famous, you know, leaders that had been imprisoned. But, you know, the thing you first see when you get in there is that type of consciousness that was, you know, open to be molded by the people like Mumia Abu-Jamal or Leonard Peltier is pretty much gone now. And the generation that has the remnants of that consciousness, you know, they're thoroughly jaded, cynical. You know, they've seen that happen and they saw that go away. You know, they lived through they lived through nonviolence and then through militancy, and then they saw it all destroyed by crack cocaine and the gang violence, and now they're old and no one cares about them and no one's listening to them. But, you know, it was that older generation, particularly the one connected to Vietnam, that was the only one that really kind of got it. And when you talk to the young brothers these days, it's just a totally different story. They're so disconnected from their political history, you know, their social history. They don't understand it. They don't know who Malcolm X is. You know, they don't know who John Brown is. You know, Medgar Evers, they don't know who these people are. And their number one concern is getting clipped by someone in a rival gang, you know, their own brother taking them out. And so when you have to fight through that first and foremost, you know, these notions, these kind of like quasi, you know, Marxist notions of, you know, a united underclass or, you know, colorblind revolution and all of this, I mean, they really get shaken out quickly. And you sound kind of silly trying to talk to them about it. But, you know, if you've understood their life and how it has existed in the street, which, you know, I had a measure of understanding because of the amount of years that, you know, I had to navigate the ghettos and to survive homeless and in shelters and a crackhead and all this stuff, you know, you learn the ins and outs of their lifestyle, you know. You understand what they're doing. You understand, you know, what it means to have to stand on the stoop of a building for 8 hours in the middle of the night and, you know, 20 below, you know, moving rock because you got to feed your kids.
Well, you know. And it's interesting, too, because if you look at, like, some of these revolutionaries like Leonard Peltier or people that do actually shift consciousness within prisons, it is those people that understand and are from those experiences, but they have to, like, they need a leader that will condense their consciousness through that empathy and through that sympathy and almost like kind of like bring them up together. You know, it's like when you're in a prison, you are surrounded by all these people with that kind of similarity underrunning all of them, these experiences of like desperation and, you know, the reasons why they did the crimes that they did, like their driving motivations. And when you can have like an individual like Malcolm X that can unite, you know, these people through their desperate acts and kind of elevate them, it seems like that's that magic moment when it can possibly occur, when there's like a single individual that can unify them through that, you know?
Yeah. And see, you know, I mean, I understand that, and I feel like, yes, that would be of such great benefit. I mean, you know, the other side of me is saying, well, you know, I mean, isn't it fair to say that we've learned enough about having, you know, leaders and having that kind of, like, you know, elevated personality to guide us instead of each of us kind of, like, finding that leader within ourselves?
Right.
And, you know, I think in some ways, you know, yeah, you know, at the time, the voices of Malcolm X, you know, and the voices, you know, later on, Mumia Abu-Jamal and Pelletier and the other prisoners, but even like Brendan Behan, you know, who wrote Borstal Boy about, you know, his time being in prison for IRA terrorism and all of that. I mean, these, you know, they're transformational narratives more than I think that they're political narratives. You know, I think that the politics really are implicit, but, you know, it's really, and I think today it's even more relevant in the sense that what we're really advocating now is transformation. And I think for people to kind of understand, you know, I'm going to get really deep and metaphorical here, but, like, looking at the empire as it exists, like, we are all somewhat imprisoned by this system. But for us to, like, truly transcend, you know, to get to that, like, post-racial America that everyone was talking about just because we elected Obama, I mean, the real path to a post-racial America is an understanding the true oppression of the underclass. And as, you know, members of the counterculture or the subculture, whatever it is that we like to call ourselves these days, it is our obligation to understand the political, you know, nature of the repression of the war on drugs. We have to understand that history. We have to understand why it exists. When you go into the prison system, it's right there in your face. You know, you can't escape it. When you've got such a disproportionality of African Americans in there, and almost all of them are in there on drug crimes, and you got all these people sitting around that, you know, the worst thing they ever did, you know, was handle a substance, you know that, you know, you've got a system that is not necessarily based in moral principles or in keeping us safe, but in, you know, making sure that that specific subclass of the population, you know, is otherwise occupied. So Eric, to answer your question from before, what happened to me was that I come from a mixed family. I have an adopted sister, she's Native American, so I've always grown up, you know, with, you know, understanding racism very firsthand because I come from this white family in this white area, and then I've got this dark-skinned sister, and people are trying to put two and two together and understand why that happened. But, you know, it put me in a place where I've been dealing with it most of my life, but, you know, I also developed a very strong affinity, you know, with the black population, you know, and I really kind of, like, felt closer and a greater sense of kinship with black guys in there and with black people in general than, you know, I normally have felt with most white people. And, you know, when you get into a situation like prison, you're dealing with people that are in prison for two different reasons. Generally, the white offenders are habitual. They tend to commit a lot of crimes and have really big rap sheets. And that's why they're kind of caught in this culture of prison and they can't get out. With most of the black kids, like, it's a rite of passage. Like, all of them are going to do some time at some point or another. And they come in and they're, you know, doing little bits and they do their time and then they go out, but it's part of the initiation of them, you know, being in the gang culture and selling drugs. So, you know, it's very different kind of motivation. And I got in there and, you know, so, you know, basically I gravitated towards black kids and I was, you know, kind of trying to break stuff down to them. In the manner that we discussed earlier about trying to raise consciousness. And I was put in a cell with an Aryan Nation chief, a guy who'd done about 8 bits, and this big old boy from downstate southern Illinois who came from a Klan family. And, you know, the overt nature of their racism, I mean, the things that they would say, you know, the epithets they would use, the way that they would just go about framing their entire day around how much they hated and despised black people was something out of the, you know, out of the 1920s in Mississippi, and yet it still existed. And so at one point in time, you know, I made the fatal mistake of asking, you know, bringing a black person into my cell, somebody who came in to, you know, pick me up to go to the chow hall one night. And I came back from chow and there was, you know, 7 very large white guys, all of these racist dudes. in this kind of you know, Aryan group waiting for me, and they explained to me quite directly that you don't cross lines and you stick with your own, and you know, they had to teach me a lesson for doing it, and they jumped me right there in the cell. You know, the whole thing happened in a matter of, you know, 30 seconds. The next thing I know, I'm, you know, completely dazed and spun out and realizing that, like, my life is now literally in danger. And I had to go through a very elaborate and clandestine process of going secretly to the administration via the librarian, who, you know, was somebody who recognized that, you know, I was a, you know, good guy and I wasn't trying to cause any trouble. I had to go into protective custody and get moved into a black cell block. And, you know, all of this is going on at a, you know, a minimum security prison that's mostly for drug offenders.
Yeah.
And this isn't even what's going on in the big giants, you know, in the maximum security giants.
Yeah.
You know, and then from that point on, I was marked as a, an informant because, you know, because I got moved. So I, that meant I talked to the administration. So that meant that I was an informant. But it didn't even matter that I wasn't. It just meant that I was now toxic. And so nobody would touch me, you know, for months because of that.
My God.
All of this is to say the physical, the emotional stress, I should say, the emotional psychological stress in prison is 1,000 times worse than the physical stress.
Yeah. Well, this is amazing stuff, but we need to take a break now. So you're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. We're talking with Charles Shaw, and we'll be right back after these messages.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
South of the border.
Hello, I'm Johnny Mueller, and I have a brand new show called The Expat Files, and it's all about living, working, playing, or retiring in Latin America. I know what it's like to buy land, build a house, start a business. I've been through it in a dozen Latin countries. So, if you're thinking about moving down, or you're just curious, be sure to listen in, Mondays and Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Down Mexico way.
The Progressive Radio Network is looking to expand its programming, and we are looking for your ideas. If there's a subject that you are passionate about and we don't cover it, let us know. Give us a call at 646-307-4482 or email our program director, Carolee@GaryKnoll.com. That's K-A-R-A-L-E-E @GaryKnoll.com. The Progressive Radio Network, the number one forum for progressive minds.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one forum that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis and Charles Shaw. We're talking about prisons and drugs, everyone's favorite topic. Charles, I was curious, you know, you mentioned that you went through like a a shamanic transformation, and it's interesting to me that you went to prison because of MDMA, which you were using to treat your post-traumatic stress disorder, just because, you know, prison is kind of seen as this thing that exists outside reality. It's like another little pocket which is hidden from the world, and a lot of people that go to prison, like, their prison time is separate than the rest of their lives. So you were already using a drug to try to reintegrate, like, this separate experience that couldn't really be integrated, you know, because it was existed like kind of outside of people's regular reality. And then you kind of get thrown into this other like sub-reality. So it's almost like you had all these little sub-realities going on. And I was just wondering, like, did you have a realization when you were really able to just integrate all of those parts into, you know, into your main reality where they were all kind of unified? Do you think it was the psychedelics that really did that, or was it, what kind of happened where you were able to bring that all together?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. I mean, I can't stress enough how important the psychedelics were in the medicinal and healing sense. They also, you know, obviously they also expanded my consciousness in the traditional sense. They gave, you know, it started giving me the confidence of vision, the ability to see large patterns, the ability to perceive past the illusions, and all the things I think that we can, you know, all kind of safely generally claim that psychedelics do for us. But there was, you know, I mean, nothing like pain to be a great motivator. And, you know, I was not a happy person. And although I had been liberated, you know, Eric and I met, like, you know, in the early stages when I had just been kind of like let loose into this whole new world, this beautiful world that, you know, we now inhabit regularly. We met at Burning Man. Actually, Daniel Pinchbeck introduced us when we were out at the Sapphire Portal one night. And, you know, it was, we were having a very interesting conversation, and I just kind of like thanked, you know, psychedelic culture for just the very existence of that conversation, the fact that I was out there and I was on this path. It took a number of years, though, before I was really able to, like, own, you know, myself and this kind of new identity that I had been building. And it was because of the, you know, one of the main themes, which is really just this idea of healing the shadow and becoming aware of the shadow and confronting it. You know, and so many people, the kind of archetype that is in popular culture now is, you know, I lived hard and lived fast and, you know, I got fame and, you know, and then I fell off in the drugs, but now I'm back, you know, and, you know, it's always like the kind of like comeback story, but they never tell you about what happened during, you know, the time when they were coming back. And so what I had was an environment in a set of circumstances that were, you know, ripe for me to be able to actually do real healing work, which was to say that I was, you know, starting to do meaningful work, which gave me confidence. You know, after, you know, spending 15 years building a writing career, I started doing some, you know, what I felt was meaningful work, and I was slowly working my way into, you know, doing work on this subject. But I found community. I found family. I found friends. You know, I found this whole network of people that were willing to reflect back to me, you know, the goodness within me, but also, you know, the pain, the darkness, to hold me accountable for that stuff. And, you know, I never really had that in the past. I never had somebody say, you know, I love you, but this part of you, this thing you're doing is hurting me. But I'll continue to love you, but please, you can't continue to do this. You know, it was always just kind of like shame and violence in the past. So, you know, as I'm now given the blessing of having friends and family and community and, you know, recognition and all of that, the obligation then becomes all that stronger on me to kind of get up on my P's and Q's and start working on these issues and start, you know, taking away bit by bit the things that are blocking me from my creativity and from intimacy and from, you know, being a much more grounded kind of like vessel for, you know, these larger, you know, messages, these social change messages that we have.
Well, I love your analogy of vessel there. I mean, when you were talking, what really came to me was the way that that culture and ritual and religion in some sense, but in subculture in other senses, becomes a kind of, can become a kind of container. And when it's strong, and by a container I mean like a vessel or a pot within which you're going to cook stuff, and it's like, well, what are you going to cook? What do you really have? And
yeah.
For a lot of us, it's mostly our shadow. You know, that while there's light and there's love and there's creativity and all the things you're talking about, in a way, that's not really what you cook. What you cook is the stuck stuff, is the thick stuff. But you can't. It's really, 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 really hard to do it. You can't do it without a container. Some people can make themselves a container, where their own, you know, in a way, the ability for the in a way, prison can be a container, just the way you were talking about. For some people, they can go in there, and the fact that they're so bored and that they're so observed and that they're so out of, you know, have no so little control and that there's so much hostility, that they have no choice but to make themselves a container within which transformation can occur. But for a lot of us, we need other people. We need scenes. And I'm really glad to hear you talk about that stuff as well, because I have a lot of issues with the psychedelic underground and a lot of the what I see is a lot of cant about transformation and mistaking extraordinary experience for transformation and
yeah.
So I think it's
ego-based stuff.
What's that?
Well, you know, mistaking, you know, things that are grounded and rooted in the ego as being transformative when they're actually regressive. You know, a lot of like, you know, so-called LSD breakthroughs that people have are really just feeding a kind of very dangerous narcissistic complex, you know, instead of, you know, transcending the person into a more of a selfless place.
Yeah. I think the way I've come to think about that problem is the psychological term inflation. And that the great danger of psychedelics, as it's also true of the occult and mysticism to some degree, is inflation, which means that you're like your ego expands into whatever new place of perception and clarity, and even if those places are actually perceptive and actually clear, that by claiming it as part of the ego's growth, you not only expand your ego, but you transform those subtler places and perceptions into forms of coercion or self-delusion and things like that. So it's a kind of bugaboo for me that there's not more kind of awareness of that alongside the kind of rhetoric of transformation. But it's hard too, because you know it's so weird. You know, your life was a very intense one. You went through a lot of hell. A lot of very difficult circumstances, certainly more difficult than mine. I mean, I've had psychological challenges, but on paper, it's nothing compared to what you're talking about. And then you, even from your perspective, you can go see, you know, whatever, a lot of the people you were in prison with, like, you're not even close to the degree of misery that they've been, had heaped upon them. And if you can make that turn, then it's like almost all the more powerful, because you can really see the mechanisms. Where I think a lot of people who are seeking healing, their issues are not as acute, they're more pervasive, and their solutions are not as acute. And so it becomes harder to navigate, harder to really affirm the structure of the container, you know, that because you need it to be really structured in order for it to do transformative work. And it's not enough to just be like, wow, man, you know, we're getting, like, so high, and we're, like, tuning into the earth, and that's going to, like, make it all better, because that's just not doing it.
Yeah, there's so much escapism, you know, Eric, that is masquerading as transformation, you know, and, I the thing about the prison experience, and I think what ends up happening with so many of the men, I mean, you know, okay, let's just be, you know, let's keep it real here for a second. I had, you know, obviously the benefits of class and education and race and all of these things that gave me a leg up from most of the people that are in this situation. And so I cannot under any circumstances discount that advantage that I had, you know, and I lament it. I lament that other people don't have it, but I'm also extremely grateful that I did have it. because it allowed me the ability to persevere. So with all due humility paid to the, you know, the gifts that I and the advantages and privileges that I had, it takes a very specific type of personality to get through this. And when you put somebody in prison, usually, you know, they're you know, and I use the word just hardened, just because you come from a tough place, you go to a tougher place, and then you come out into an even tougher place. And it takes a strength, a container wall, if you will, to hold in, you know, a being of that strength. There aren't a lot of container walls that are built strong enough in our culture, in our society, to hold these people. So they just become, the only thing that really becomes strong enough to hold them is a prison wall.
Mm.
You know, and so it's like this, you know, this cycle that just keeps going. I was, you know, blessed and cursed for being the stubbornest person I know, because I just simply wouldn't let this hold me down. I simply had to get past it one way or the other. But I don't see most of the people that are dealing with this, they're not blessed with the same, you know, the same conviction.
Yeah.
And
well, one of the things that's remarkable about ayahuasca is that while I have some concerns about how ayahuasca's being kind of represented in the you know, in the underground and or whatever you want to call it, in the neo-tribal scene, one thing that's very impressive to me about it and very interesting, is that if you compare it to other ethnobotanicals that have entered into modern Western psychedelic culture, like peyote or magic mushrooms, is that unlike those, it's retained some kind of container in the experience of it. So that even if, like, it's some white kid with dreadlocks who's leading a ceremony, excuse me, I'm losing my voice, you got, there's a container, there's a structure, there's a ritual structure, there's a circle, there's songs, there's interaction, there's people telling their stories the next day. And I think it's really significant that amidst all the craziness of our culture and all the craziness of the counterculture and all the crap, that it's retained this form, or it's transforming, keeping a form. And that to me is one of the reasons that I take the stories of transformation so seriously in that with that particular culture.
Yeah. Well, Eric, I mean, part of what you're talking about, I mean, has a lot to do with the I Ching, right? I mean, the I Ching describes itself as Bispi, which is the cauldron, the vessel, the cooking pot where you put things in. And what it is the form of the archetype. Right, which an archetype is something which has the potential for all forms. So it's literally like those stories of the cultures that you're talking about, those do become the containers that people are able to have the transformation happen through. It's the form of the stories.
Hey, Mazi, you're echoing really, really bad. So can you? We'll try to fix that.
She sounds good to me.
Oh, that's odd. Well,
yeah, she sounds real good to me. Well, you know, the other thing that I think we're overlooking in the most simple sense about ayahuasca, though, and what I think is really significant, and Adam Ellenbaugh would really argue with me about this, and he tends to take issue about this one thing, is that, I firmly believe that, you know, ayahuasca is, you know, the great feminine spirit. It's the divine feminine spirit. It's the manifestation of what we understand to be divine feminine, at least in this setting and in this context. And because of its significance of the divine feminine in as the, you know, the kind of like fundamental basis of this revolution, the spiritual revolution, you know, I think it's rooting because it's the main vehicle by which she's making herself known. It's a clumsy way of trying to describe it, but I hope you follow me on that,
You think there's something special about this psychoactive spirit compared to others as a relationship to the divine feminine?
Yeah, I really feel like because of, you know, it's a particular zeitgeist. I believe that, you know, the key to this revolution right now in this epoch is, you know, the rebalancing of divine feminine and masculine. It is about, you know, the women finally retaking their place at the table, recreating the circle of the village, you know. And so perhaps all of it is some kind of expression of us kind of reconnecting with that feminine spirit, that we form the circle, that we take the medicine, that we are healed by it, that we are embraced by this great mother spirit, reborn, all of these things. And so we're each going through the rebirth, you know, to take our place in, you know, this culture of the new paradigm.
Right, right.
Right.
Well, that's good. Those good words. I'm realizing we're winding down here, and I wanted to make sure that you had time to talk a little bit about your Voices project.
Yes. Okay. Well, along the way, I was fortunate enough to begin working with the Open Democracy Group in the United Kingdom, and built a relationship with the Sainsbury Foundation there. And they helped me finish Exile Nation, which anybody who wants to read Exile Nation now can read the first volume on Reality Sandwich for free. It ran as a serial from 1 year ago until next week, where it will conclude. And then I will be archiving it all on exilenation.org within a month or so. It will appear in print through the Evolver editions, you know, sometime next year or something like that. But Unheard Voices was an offshoot project. What I wanted to do was to give back, to create some kind of public service about the effects of the war on drugs and the criminal justice system in America. And modeling this after the Shoah Institute, which was a video archive of testimonials about the Holocaust, I set about to record as many stories as I can, and I've decided on filming and archiving on the web 100 interviews. And these 100 interviews represent the 1 in 100 people that is currently incarcerated. They are stories that span the entire experience, so there'll be a long interview with somebody who is either a prisoner, an ex-offender, a family member or loved one connected to somebody in the system, or an expert, activist, or organizer. I've filmed 58 interviews so far. I'm in the process of cutting together the first 10, and a short film that will be about the project, which will be released in February of 2011.
Well,
and it's called the Unheard Voices Project, and you can find it on Open Democracy and YouTube, and it was an extraordinary experience traveling around the country, meeting all these people for a number of months, and so I'm really proud to be able to help speak for them now.
Well, for someone listening to this, you know, broadcast, I'm sure a lot of people would go like, God, you know, how do I help to break down this wall or whatever? And what would you say someone who doesn't have the direct connection with maybe someone who's incarcerated, but you know wants to help break down that wall?
Well, you know, there's lots of groups that, you know, do prisoner services, you know, coordination, because there aren't really any social services or anything to help prisoners. So you can find groups that can help you start, you know, a pen pal relationship, or if you want to try to help, you know, a reentry organization, you know, there's groups like the Safer Foundation in Illinois. Or like the John Howard Association, you know, they're like a prison monitoring group. The problem, Eric, is that there really isn't that much out there.
And it's
set up so that people don't really, you know, it's not easy for them to plug into, because they don't want people really kind of getting involved in this. But if you look, you know, or if you contact me, you know, anyone can email me at, you know, charles.shaw@opendemocracy.net. You know, there's a whole network of organizations that could definitely use financial support and volunteer support. And more than anything else, you know, all of you've had some kind of run-in with the law at some point. If you're living in the subculture, if you're enjoying psychedelic medicine, if you're going to festivals, you're breaking the law like everybody else. Except that, you know, maybe your class privilege or your racial privilege is keeping you out of prison. So think about that privilege and think about how you might be able to turn around and help others who maybe, like, didn't have, you know, as good a luck or as many advantages as you.
Yeah,
you don't
it's really remarkable when you think about, like, just the category of drugs or drug culture. And one of the things that we didn't have time to ask, maybe I can have you on again sometime, is just that that you've experienced two very different kinds of drug cultures that are often lumped together when we talk about drugs or illegal substances or whatever. And that's, you know, one interesting contrast between urban crack scene and, you know, a neo-tribal psychedelic, you know, rave scene or something. Obviously very different worlds. But one of those differences that's captured by this, you know, balance is precisely the privilege involved, in that they're part of the trouble I have with the neo-tribal scene is that because they don't have to deal with as much reality, obviously people get busted and there's problems, et cetera, no doubt about it. People are very concerned about these things, but I think it's very easy for people to go through that world in kind of a la-la mentality, even though on that legal level there's this deep connection. So there's actually a very profound bond between, you know, privileged countercultures and these other scenes that where they don't have that protection, and yet there's not as nearly the awareness that you would expect brotherhood.
Yeah, it's outright denial too, Eric. I mean, it's not even just the awareness. It's like they don't even want to. They don't want to think about it. But it's like they don't even act with any type of appropriate humility or deference to the power that's surrounding them. They walk around with, like, in this bubble of impunity or perceived impunity. And then when the bubble's popped and they get busted for something, then they react, you know, with alacrity. Oh, my goodness, how could this be? This is injustice, you know, and all of this stuff, not realizing that, you know, it's only because of the emphasis on class and race that you haven't felt the same type of awful, invasive experience that, you know, poor people are dealing with every single day.
Yeah, it's a real shame about our society, and you know, in some ways I could even blame the left a little bit, is that any kind of consciousness based on class, particularly class, but, you know, race as well, it's so hard for people to get to, and even people that you would think they're progressive, they're open to alternative views and this and that, but they'll reflect on themselves in certain ways. But reflecting on your privilege is really uncomfortable for a lot of people, and I think they're like, oh, no, that's Marxism, we're done with that, don't mention class, I don't want to hear that word, and it's a very deep aspect of American culture now. Maybe it's always been there, except for the 60s and early 70s. But it's really profound. I mean, do you have any sense of what that is, what that block is? Because you must encounter it a lot during the work you do in the scenes you move through.
Yeah, and you know, I would hate to like get so pedantic as to say that it's the culture war, but you know, it's the culture war.
It's the culture war, idiot.
You know, it's like, in the popular narrative right now, you know, liberalism failed, right? It failed. And the reason it failed is because we had the ghetto riots of the late 60s and 70s, and then we had crack, and then we had all of this stuff. And there is this story out there that all of these efforts to try to improve society along liberalism failed, okay? So, and instead, what arose in their place is, you know, Reagan and the conservative revolution. So now when you're starting to talk about things like, well, why does this culture of crime exist? We no longer are talking about economics. You have people like Mark Klyman who are saying that the reason that there's so much crime in you know, starting in the 60s, and the reason that it's concentrated in the ghettos is because there aren't enough parents around to keep these unruly kids in line.
You know, Charles, I'm going to have to cut you off there. It's totally great stuff, and
I knew
it was going to be an awesome conversation. I just want to remind people that, you know, you can, of course, just Google Charles Shaw and go to Reality Sandwich to read stuff on Exile Nation. But I also really recommend the Exile Nation videos on the opendemocracy.net. So check that out as well. Hey, Charles, from me and Maja, I just want to say thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, man. You kept me and Michael Garfield company while we were driving the whole country for 2 months with Expanding Minds, so we really appreciate being able to pay back the favor.
Right on. All right, well, keep your minds open.